The Conservatives are the largest party. They don't have an overall majority at this stage. The Prime Minister called this election because she wanted certainty and stability. This doesn't seem to look like certainty and stability.
Welcome to Polling Politics. This week's podcast is sponsored by Ladbrokes Political Betting. I'm Joe Twyman, co-founder of Delta Poll.
And I'm freelance political journalist Marie Leconte.
This week, we are joined by Gawain Towler. Gawain is former director of comms at UKIP, but after 13 years, he had a conscious uncoupling, I think, from the party in February this year, and is now founder of CWC Strategy and executive secretary for the Museum of Brexit.
Indeed, indeed.
Gawain, hello.
Hello there.
Thank you for joining us. Tell us a bit about the Museum of Brexit.
It's essentially an academic rather than a jolly thing. I mean, the idea that school trips, and you'll go, it's Saturday afternoon, what am I going to do with a 13-year-old? I know, I'm going to drag him down to the Museum of Brexit. That's probably not really what we're at. Though I have considered setting up a butter mountain for the children so they can build your own mountain, or
who doesn't want to play
with a butter mountain? and for the parents, a wine lake. Drink your own wine lake, build your own butter mountain. That'd be great. But no, it's essentially, it's an academic thing. There are many publicly funded departments, university departments of European Integration Studies. We don't have a publicly funded department of European Disintegration Studies. And this, in some ways, there's a 50-year campaign to get us out, which we thought we'd done. Until 15 years ago, everything was on paper. These days, you'd have to collect WhatsApp messages and things of that sort. Whereas in the past, there's a lot of all the little flyers from pub meetings in the 80s and 70s. One has to remember the activities of people like Peter Shaw and Tony Benn and the people who kept the flag alive and the flame of British independence alive over that period. They will be forgotten. And in 25 years' time, given that we do actually leave, those people are going to be scratching their heads thinking, how did that happen? Because nobody's been collecting the history of how we got to that point. There's a lot of stuff on why we should stay in, and the Monet professors of this, that, and the other, who have been collecting, and there are collections of the sort of pro-European and why we are in, but we voted to leave. And unless that stuff is collected, historians of the future really will be scratching their heads. How did that happen? It came completely left field. It wasn't left field, not out in the country. It may have been left field for some people who live in the Westminster environs and the academe and places like that, who didn't realise this was happening because they'd speak in that vacuum and in that echo chamber. But out there in the country, it wasn't that weird, so much so that they actually voted to leave. It is those people, the people who are having pub meetings of six people for decades, campaigning quietly for years and years and years, that's what it's for. It's to collect what was happening there, what was happening, and so that future academics can have a body of work that they can work from.
Well, Brexit is obviously one of the major news stories of this week, and we'll come back to that in just a second. But first, I want to discuss Donald Trump and his arrival in Britain. He's here for a few days. He's meeting the Queen. He's meeting Theresa May. He's meeting the US ambassador. He's spending what appears to be as little time in London as possible. Days of protest are planned. Gawain, how do you think the government and the country more generally should respond to his arrival?
Well, I mean, if France can welcome him effectively, but with a little jibe with their band, but by and large, France, which is no great fan of the US and particularly not of Trump, is able to behave like a grown-up nation. It's a sad illustration of this country that we can't. That being said, we are a rumbustious, the land of Gilray and Rowlandson. Don't expect to be welcomed with open arms, no matter who. I mean, there was protests against, small ones, against Obama. I wish we'd had the similar level of protests when President Xi came over. After all, he's a murdering communist dictator, whereas Trump isn't. However, so be it. I think the people of London will be delighted that Trump's not coming here, if only that we don't have half the city closed down for motorcades. When major leaders turn up in this country, that everything locks down. It's like FIFA or the Olympics, where you have special Zill lanes for people with their motorbikes and all the rest of it, the cavalcade. So broadly, he's meeting Queenie. They're down to Windsor, and that'll be all jolly. And then he's got Blenheim, hasn't he? So he's got,
and Chequers as well, I think. Yeah. He's basically doing the tour around the M25.
Three nice places to visit. I'd go. I've never been to Chequers. It'd be quite nice, I'm sure. And then he's off to play golf.
And you talk about not behaving maturely as a country. Do you think there's something not mature about a large inflatable baby-shaped chomp?
Personally, I think it's quite funny. Well,
I was going to say, I'm actually... I guess I'm going to be the killjoy on that one. But I think how much money was raised? I think it was around sort of like 17K or something. If you're going to want to spend that money, like then, I don't know, like send it to places trying to reunite children with their families at the border in the US. Like spend it, if you're going to have that money to spend, just spend it on something useful. Trump's not going to see the baby. Just, you know, no one important is going to see the baby.
You say Trump's not going to see the baby.
They'll see the reportage.
It's inevitable that that will be covered, if not by Fox News, which I think we can agree is probably the only channel that he does watch. It's going to be covered by the other channels. It's going to be a big vocal, point.
If there is a press conference, he'll be asked about it. I'm vaguely amused, of course, that the counter balloon raised more money.
Is there a counter balloon?
Sadiq balloon.
There's the crying Sadiq baby.
Remarkable.
Which raised more money in response to the crying Trump.
Are they going to duke it out, the two of them, over Parliament Square?
Bouncing blimps in Parliament Square would be... Well, it'd be something. It's like an upside-down game of Conkers.
I hate this country sometimes.
But that's
and that's
half
why
the joy.
You might be sent home. As you said, we've had protests against US presidents over the years. I think the record is Reagan, who had 115,000 protesters against his first visit in 1982. Oh,
what a dreadful fellow he was, bringing down the communist regimes of the East and all the rest of it. Yeah, and a dreadful, dreadful man.
Do you think from a comms point of view, do you think this will have any impact in the States or on Donald Trump at all?
Nope.
Or will he actually revel in it?
I think he'll quite enjoy it. He likes to be the centre of attention. This makes him a massive centre of attention. He seems to be somebody who enjoys that oppositional aspect of politics. That was his entire campaign. It was very oppositional. It was very aggressive. And if people are aggressive back, he revels in it. So fine. But the funniest thing is the you can't see Nigel Farage. When did any government turn round to the President of America and say, you will do what we say? Now, I don't say he's going to see Nigel Farage. However, if anything's going to make him want to, it's being told by number 10 he can't. It's just an extraordinary thing to have let out.
I do kind of agree that it was a weird choice. But coming back on your point before that, I think that does that mean that there's no way to win against Trump? Because, you know, if you like welcome him, he'll love the attention. If you kind of, you know, do protests and everything, he'll love the attention. So like, should everyone just sort of like pretend to like have something else to do that day, like literally not mention it, pretend he's not coming
there
over.
There is another protest that day. You can go and do that protest instead, isn't there? There's some disability rights protest or something, I think.
Perhaps you're spoiled for choice when it comes to protests.
I can tell you. There are definitely other protests.
I was not planning to go on any protests.
Of course, the protests are going to be very confused because there's, I think, three or four different anti-Trump protests.
On different days in different places.
I think there's more than one in London, though. I think they're going to be converging marches and God knows what else.
I believe the biggest one starts at 2 p.m. on Friday at the BBC, walking from Portland Place down to Trafalgar Square, where a number of people will be speaking. I don't know if the Trump baby balloon will be following that or whether it will
stay
moored.
No, I think it's tethered.
Yeah, stay moored at Parliament.
I think it's a tethered
balloon.
We used to have one in Kennington Park, but that's mostly for the cricket.
Just
a blimp. They tether them quite effectively. Obviously, London had many blimps in the past.
For a whole host of reasons.
Indeed. The Goodyear blimp and things of this sort. I mean, we are pro-blimp.
If there's one thing we can all agree on, it's our support.
Pro the causes of blimps.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. As a senior person at UKIP, did you get to meet Trump?
No. I didn't go on that track. That was a Farage, Team Farage rather than Team UKIP. Event.
Would you have liked to have met him?
Of course. He's an extraordinary figure. Of course I'd be interested. I'd like to meet all sorts of people, not all of whom I approve of, but it doesn't stop me being interested in meeting
him. I agree. I think he would be a fascinating person to meet.
I wouldn't mind meeting John Lansman. That doesn't make me a supporter.
that would attract less attention. posing with John Lansman.
No, hold on.
In front of a gold elevator, that would be amazing.
But you get my point. He's a fascinating figure. He is an important figure in the world. Of course you'd be interested to meet him. You'd be a peculiar person not to be interested in meeting somebody.
Can I just say that I think the one thing I'm finding quite funny about this trip is the fact that Philip May is going to have to entertain Melania, I think, for quite a lot of it. And I can just picture sort of, you know, Theresa May and Donald Trump coming back after a few days, clearly sort of like hating each other. They hated every second, you know, of that visit. And in the corner of the room, there's kind of like Melania and Phil having cocktails. We're like, oh, back already.
So he's playing cribbage.
And speaking of things that have generated an awful lot of discussion, let's move on to Brexit. What a few days it has been. And by few days, I mean approximately 50 years. We've seen the resignation of David Davis, the resignation of Boris Johnson, the resignation of a number of other people who are...
Ben Bradley, how will the Conservative Party survive without Ben Bradley, the MP known only because he once said that poor people should have vasectomies? Like, how will it carry on?
He did also win Parliamentary Beard of the Year, did he not?
Oh, fair enough. I was being unkind. There's a beard in the bad comments.
Well, I think you know, you've got to look at your star players and think, well, where will the next Beard of the Year winner come from if you're the Conservative?
Probably from the House of Lords.
Yeah. 2/3 of people think the government is doing a bad job in the negotiations.
The other third, what are they thinking?
Presumably, what are the other third thinking?
Oh, no, brilliant. Absolute starring role she's playing. Everything's absolutely tickety-boo. Brilliant piece of negotiation there from Mrs. May. What? A third of the people of this country think that?
No, a third of the people either don't know, which is a large portion.
Which is probably more sensible.
Aren't paying attention. Gawain, how do you think Brexit is going? and I imagine this will not be a one-word answer.
Well, it's shocking, isn't it? I'm beginning to have a sneaking admiration for the Prime Minister because I've got a horrible suspicion that this is what she was trying to do all along. She was a soft Remainer, and this is a sort of soft Remainer fudge that she's produced. I'm beginning to wonder, and even at the time when she set her cabinet and put Boris in that job and put David Davis in that job and put Fox in that job and Gove, and basically she corralled them into a position where the main Brexiteers at the top of the Tory party were put into jobs that were going to be almost impossible for them to do effectively while she was running the show. And she's managed to completely undermine them, and the Ollie Robbins thing is just part of that. So I'm beginning to wonder... And history will tell us. I'm beginning to wonder if, to a certain extent, this is rolling out exactly as she hoped and as she planned. She never wanted to leave in the first place. She's setting up the rulebook concept where we will still be under ECJ judgments on certain matters. So the ECJ still has a role in the UK, which is the sort of thing... And she's perfectly happy for the passport issue and things of that sort, no big deal. It begins to look like an Indian princely state. They were nominally independent, but actually the British government ran them all. And as soon as Britain left, they all collapsed and just swept them all up into a single country. And that sort of level of, oh, you can have your marching bands and you can have your purple passport or blue passport or whatever. To all intents and purposes, we will be still within the remit of the European Union.
But it's still,
this suits.
The UK under like the Chequers plan would still be out of the customs union, out of the single market, like, you know, put an end to free movement, be able to make its own trade deals.
Like, no, what more? It's not, though, is it? It's end of free movement apart from, it's out of the single market, well, apart from
because it's
goods
always,
and
like, the UK
product.
Is always going to if be we... close to the EU. That's not, you can't just push the country physically out into the ocean and ignore your closest neighbours. Like, I didn't think
Nor would we, but we don't have to accept the rulings of the ECJ. There's absolutely no reason for that at all. You can have trade without that. You can do business without those things. As I understood it, the Chequers agreement, you have that. There are caveats all the way down. We're going to be out of this, but we're going to be out of that, but. And the use of the word colony, I think, in Boris's letter was very advised. He was an American citizen until 2 years ago. To America, and as Foreign Secretary, he also knows that the attitude of people who are in colonies, are citizens of colonies of other countries, is not a good place to be. And to an American, the very term colonist is very powerful. It's something that's right
that
through
was
you.
That's also really distasteful when you look at, you know, how colonialism went.
I think
comparing sort of the UK's current situation, that was just really distasteful.
Well, I think it's more the state side rather than the, say, Africa or India or elsewhere. I think it's that, as an American citizen, that you the idea of a colonist is a very powerful driver for independence and things of this sort. I mean, I don't think we're talking about empire. I think we're talking about America in the way he thinks of that word. I may be wrong. And I think to that extent, it was a specifically chosen word to represent that feeling of being the history of American War of Independence, being be that as it may, but that feeling of being dominated by friends, not a massive difference. The American colonists and the British were very, very similar, but there was a level of domination, and I think that's the relationship he's talking about, rather than, say, Nigeria or an African country or a Caribbean country or elsewhere.
But then I'd argue that actually at the end of the day, you know, the vote was still, you know, 52-48. It was not sort of like 70-30 or anything. So wouldn't there be a point in saying, and again, you know, I actually think that, you know, this is not the softest possible Brexit by all means, you know, if we were to take the Chequers deal.
Well,
surely there's an argument in saying, well, actually, you know, this was a very close vote. We will leave, and we will leave the sort of, you know, like main institutions and, you know, lose freedom of movement and stuff like that. But also, yeah, again, it was a close thing. It was not, you know, the entire country kind of like clamouring to leave.
I think we're doing those June 16 arguments. But I would suggest to you, with the vast panoply of the state, the unions, big business, most of the media on one side of the argument, the fact that it was so close is hardly a surprise. It is amazing that Leave won with that huge weight on the other side. I really believe that. Okay, so it's 4% gap, yeah? Not a huge gap, I agree. But given the sheer weight, I mean, even with all the whinging about this, that and the other, did Vote Leave do this, did Vote Leave... The spend was 2-1, not including the 9 million spent on a pamphlet sent through everybody's door that said that they would do what we said. Would do the Article 15 the next day. Oh, no, actually, I'm going to resign the next day, and everything's pushed into the long grass. So that closeness, I think it's remarkable we voted Leave at all in those circumstances. And I don't think, I mean, the balance was just, there was no balance up until that point. It was mostly on one side of the argument, and the Project Fear, and da-da-da-da-da-da. Given that, I think the gap, morally, even though not on paper, was significantly greater than that. I think it's astonishing that it was won at all.
But then on the other side, you know, Vote Leave did manage to kind of consistently promise all things to all people. So, you know, you could argue as well that, you know, they didn't kind of play entirely fair
power,
either.
Without the power, without the reach, without... And
look, yeah, but still,
I remember on the day that silly thing went on the side of a bus, we rebelled against it. UKIP certainly did. Leave.eu rejected it entirely. I know that people... More than half of the board of Vote Leave opposed it, but it was a fait accompli. They were given it, and it was too late. They had to go with it because it was on the side of a bus before they knew. So that was one particular thing. The rest, until we leave, we cannot get the benefits. The benefits of Brexit only happen once we've left. We cannot get them whilst we're still controlled and legally obliged to apply everything that comes from Brussels. That's the case.
But that wasn't my point. I think it's just talking to, for example, okay, so talking to a friend of mine quite recently who campaigned for Leave and is a, you know, sort of like conservative activist. And he was saying, even though, you know, he's still very much a Leaver now, but he did say that he did feel uncomfortable with the fact that actually when he went to campaign with Vote Leave, it was very much a case of, again, promising all things to all people. And even at the time, he did realise that the versions of Brexit...
He's a conservative activist. Mm. He's worked in election campaigns. And things of that sort. If you're in politics, almost all parties promise all things to all things all the time.
No, but that was sort of like directly contradicting. So like each sort of thing, you know, would be, because again, you know, there are a million different kinds of Brexit, you know, the kind of open Brexit, closed, etc. And it was very much kind of contradicting versions of what would happen if the UK were to leave the EU.
One of the questions that came quite regularly, OK, so what's going to happen next? What happens after we leave? I thought that was one of the selling points is the answer, I don't know, in that... That's the whole point. The whole point of Brexit is to allow the people of this country to elect. If we want to vote for rule by Caracas and vote in Mr. Corbyn and his team, sort of anti-Semitism via Caracas, I don't know. But if we want to do that, then that's our choice. Whereas, whilst we remain in the EU, it doesn't really matter who you vote for because most of the rules, and it is most of the rules, come from elsewhere. So the not being able to say what will happen next is actually... What will happen next is the people of this country decide the future of this country rather than the people of other countries. That's the key point. And I can't tell you what happens because we don't know what future elections are going to bring.
When you look at the data on this, you see that what people's expectations are, both for Leavers and Remainers, it's very mixed about what they want. And you have some people who wish to maintain close links with Europe. You have some people who wish to remain part of the single market but control various different things. If you're Theresa May or any other government, how do you deal with that huge range, regardless of how it came about? How do you deal with that wide range of expectations?
in the same way that politicians always deal with that wide range of expectations. They get elected, they make a decision, they do it, and they carry it out to the best of their abilities. And then, if the country doesn't like it, they get chucked out and somebody else gets elected. And that's how it works. You don't go in saying, what I'm going to do is I'm going to win this election, and what I'm going to do is half my plan of action over the next 5 years to do what the other side who lost wanted. That's not how it works.
But isn't that
you do what you've been asked to do by the electorate, which was to leave, and we were given explicit stuff in that 9 million leaf that went through every door. This is what will happen. You will be leaving the single market. You will do. That's what we were given, everybody. So if that is the case, you do that because that's what the country demanded. Now, I'm perfectly happy to have a third referendum with the same gap between the first two to bed it down.
So once a deal is struck, assuming that a deal can be struck with Brussels of some form, mm-hmm. you would be happy to have a second referendum?
No, with the same gap.
That.
We had 40 years to bed the EU in, and let's have 40 years to bed independence in, and let's see if we work to rejoin after 40 years.
You heard it here first, folks. 40 years until that. Around 1 in 7 people think that the Chequers deal will be good for Britain, but more than half don't know. Just over a quarter would think that the Chequers deal respects the result of the referendum, but 44% of people don't know. And fewer than 1 in 5, 19%, would be happy if the Chequers deal went through, but 46% of people don't know.
I think that's reasonable, because basically most people don't know what the Chequers agreement is, so how can they have an opinion on it?
Exactly, and it strikes me that this then becomes an issue of communications and narratives. Yep. And my sense is that Boris and David Davis resigning will help to influence people's decisions in that respect.
No, I agree, and I think to like carry this one forward as well, I think that what I'm finding slightly annoying with especially sort of like conservative politicians, the one who resigned or is sort of like thinking of resigning, is saying, you know, well, my constituents will not stand for that Chequers deal because that's not Brexit. And actually, as we've seen in the polling, most people have not followed, you know, have not followed the news closely enough to be sure that, you know, whether this is the Brexit they want or not. So actually, those MPs who are trying to, I think, especially Maria Caulfield and Ben Bradley, saying, we're going to lose our seats if this is what we're doing. It's like, no, you're not. If you actually stand by the PM and actually say, you know, this is actually a Brexit deal we're happy with, then your voters will probably follow you on that.
Look at the letters page in the Telegraph. Look at the fact that in the last few days, UKIP has seen a massive spike in membership, a sort of a 5% increase in 2 days. Look at the fact that there are people going on their internets and all the rest of it and put photographs of this is my membership card cut up. Tory party members and Tory party supporters are probably more attuned to what's going on than the general public because they're...
nerds.
Anoraks, political anoraks. They are more likely to have been following it, and they are much more likely to be writing to their MP saying, how dare you? I've been knocking on the doors in the rain and the mist and the fog and all the rest of it, and you're going to betray me? They are the people who will be communicating with their MPs, and so therefore the very visceral dislike of what's happening. I mean, what you have is an increasing... and. One of the reasons one hoped that Brexit was going to provide, and I say I think it will down the line, is reconnecting people with their politicians. You have a Remain Commons, but you have a Leave electorate, by and large. And we can only judge by those who voted. We can't judge by the people who claim that, well, the people who didn't vote obviously wanted to remain, are talking junk. But the point being is that the people who are communicating with their MPs... And they can look at the results in the referendum in their own constituents, and they know that people were worked up about it. But I've seen just from what's coming into UKIP right now, it's astonishing. The down in Devon, where we have our office, over Sunday, the system broke down. There were so many membership applications coming in. It was extraordinary.
But there are
people talking at local council level. There are people talking about defecting. This hasn't happened for 4 years. There's something going on there. And the Tory MPs who are resigning their thing are aware of this because it's in their inbox.
So what do you think will happen now to UKIP?
My general feeling is it was an absolute cluster something. And between the referendum, Farage going, three leaders in various states of disarray, Batten comes in. He's not the world's most exciting man, but he's dependable, solid. The membership know him. He's been a member from day one. He's trusted. If not applauded, he went to the party. We were going bankrupt. He went to the party, the small membership as it was then, under 20,000, and said, we need £100,000 to survive. They produced £300,000, which from a small membership was astonishing. They trusted him. We then had the bills created the legal bills created by the libel case for one of our MEPs, had upset some people up in Yorkshire. That was a couple of hundred grand. He found the money for that. There hasn't been a full-time press officer since January. He's found the money for a full-time press officer starting next month. He's doing the business. We were, as Henry Bolton told, and it was true, we were hemorrhaging 1,000 members a month. That has turned round. It's stable. Article 50 process finishes in the end of March. The next scheduled elections in this country, I note the word scheduled, but the next scheduled elections in this country are in May, beginning of May. Council elections, borough and some counties. If UKIP managed to get, and we're working at it, if UKIP managed to get all of those selected, candidates in all of those wards, Brexit looks like the mess it looks like it is, and the government do not do what they were told to do by the electorate, what price do UKIP going from 3-5% today up to 15% again? I would say that that's a perfectly reasonable bet in those circumstances. And if that happens, UKIP's threat was never winning seats. UKIP's threat was always taking that 10-15% out of the middle so the main parties didn't know who was going to win. Our threat was existential rather than electoral in that way. It was only that threat of them losing their seats rather than UKIP winning ours that forced the referendum in the first place. And the only way you can make a politician do something is threaten their job. Otherwise, they can ignore. And the death of UKIP, or the all near death of UKIP post-referendum, has allowed this situation to arise. There was no threat. There's no threat from Labour on Brexit. There's no threat from the Lib Dems on Brexit. There's no threat to the government on Brexit. Not an electoral threat. And the near death of UKIP has allowed this situation to be the mess it is. If you see UKIP coming back up to 10-15%, as I think they will at the next council elections, suddenly that electoral threat's there again. And it might hopefully will keep people a bit more honest.
I would imagine that rise to 10-15% will be influenced at least in part by the return of Nigel Farage. Now, Nigel Farage is someone that you've worked with.
It's happening anyhow.
He's someone you've worked with a lot over the years, and there's no doubt that he has a huge influence on these things. Can you see him coming back?
What he said this week about the possibility of coming back, he set two red lines, and his red lines were the postponement or cancellation of the Article 50 process. Now, the Commission told Gerard Batten in Parliament last week in Brussels that that was not going to happen. Absolutely clearly, no. So, if that's Nigel's red lines, I'm not 100% sure that he's coming back, given that, why would he? He set himself, if this happens, then I will do this. You've got to remember, he's a brilliant campaigner, of that we all know. Again, he's somebody who's very popular outside those circles in which most of us here move. In the country, he's still very popular. Even now, you walk down the street with him, and it's selfie after selfie after selfie, signature after signature after signature, whichever part of the country he's in. This assumption that he's regarded as some monster, it's not what I see on the street. It really isn't. It's extraordinary.
Do you speak to him regularly?
Yeah.
When was the last time you spoke to him?
Just before the weekend.
Did he say...
No, he liked his surprises.
Right, okay.
He always has. I mean, he has that theatrical aspect to him that works very well. But I think there are many in the party who are not quite as enamoured of him as people outside the party, because he did go away. And Gerard has put in a huge amount of work to stabilise things. He can't just assume that he's going to waltz in.
But does he necessarily need to waltz in to be leader? I mean, he could just return to a more active role in frontline politics.
Is absolutely something he should be doing, and I think he probably needs to do. And he is a very effective leader in that sense, not necessarily the party leader.
What about the role of what you describe as Team Farage? So Nigel Farage, Aaron Banks, Andy Wigmore. Do you think they come back as a group, or is it just Farage himself? Does he need those people around him?
No, he enjoys their company. They're fun. But does he need, in the sense that I think you're meaning, does he need them? No, but he enjoys their company. They are. They're a hoot. They are great fun to be around. It's a little bit boys' weekend out type aspect to it, and they are great fun. However, I don't think that they are necessary for him to get back on the campaign trail. Obviously, getting back on the campaign trail does cost money, but I don't think we'd have... UKIP has never had trouble raising money for campaigns. That's not a problem. We have trouble raising money for paperclips, but if you ask somebody for money and you can say, and it's going on that poster, or it's going on these public meetings, no problem at all. If you say it's to pay the press officer, what should we want those for? But if Nigel's out on campaigning, the money will come. And he doesn't need banks to provide it. No, but he'll still want to
banks
have
banks as in Aaron Banks, yeah. Not yeah, as in financial, financial institutions.
Yeah, but he doesn't need banks, Wigmore. He doesn't need that team to provide that money. That money we will be able to raise without any trouble at all. And actually, how Gerard has managed to raise the money over the last 6 months shows that.
On the subject of Wigmore and all of your roles on this, in August 2017, the bad boys of Brexit was described as being snapped up by a Hollywood studio and turned into a £60 million six-part TV series.
You've been talking to Wigmore again, haven't
you? Well, this came ultimately from Wigmore, who did describe his part of his job as leading journalists up the garden path.
It wasn't straight to Christopher Hope by any chance, was it?
How did you guess?
This one. I'm bored. I've got nothing to write. What if I write? I know. I'll phone up Wigmore. He'll tell me something. Well, that's the case then, right? Front page of the Telegraph.
If only it was about the royal yacht, he'd be onto a real winner.
It's some embroidered thing, and suddenly, my favourite one of those moments was an email was sent in after the Supreme Court judgment. One person sent an email, said, we should have a protest. And I looked at this and I said, oh, by the way, somebody sent this in. We dismissed it. Next day, front page in the Mail, front page in the Telegraph, Farage to lead hundreds of thousand people on a march to Andy? Literally one person wrote an email in and it became the front and Farage's marching on the Supreme Court with 200,000 at his back. It says, what?
That must make your job more interesting.
Never dull. Never dull. No. But I mean, you've either got that or the famous infamous gay floods and things of this sort. Being UKIP press officer, it's not sleepwalking.
More of a nightmare?
No, I've always said, and I still believe, and this is something where as a party, we've always been slightly unusual. We like our members.
It's almost unheard of, the
leadership of the party actually likes the members, which is a peculiar thing, because really, we're all activists. There is no career in UKIP, as I found out when I tried to leave and I couldn't get a job. That doesn't happen. And so therefore, everybody is in it together in that sense. It has always been the case that the most important letter in UKIP is the I, not the UK. And they are ornery, and they are fractious, and they are difficult, and they are all sorts of other things. One might say eccentric at times, and worse at times. But I would far prefer to deal with, out of 100, 5 to 10 that are difficult, and the other 90 to 95 being independent-minded and driven, than your average of most of the other political parties, where they're deadly dull.
Theresa May, mm-hmm. What do you think is going to happen to her?
I think she'll survive. I can't see what does survive look like? Survive looks like her sitting in number 10 and having a weekends at Chequers for the next couple of years.
Right, until the next election? Or
yeah.
So you think,
you think she'll
contest the next election?
Unless she feels post the Article 50 process, post the Brexit deal is done, she feels that I've done it and she could walk away and force an early election after that. But I can't see her going before then. And I can't see the Tory, and Jacob Rees-Mogg and people like this, he can't bring himself to vote against. They're such loyalists. The Tory party are such loyalists that even if they resign their positions as a minister, they're not going to take that next step. And you would be properly self-destructive if you were a Tory backbencher and you brought May down now. The fact that Labour are also clueless is neither here nor there. You are opening the door to Caracas, as I say. It would be a ridiculous thing to do, and I don't think most Tory MPs are actually ridiculous. They might sound it sometimes, they might look it sometimes, but at heart they don't want to lose their jobs.
And I agree, and I don't think they've got the numbers either, so they're the kind of ERG lot being like, you know, we've got the 48 letters, fine, but you can get the 48 letters, but it very much is another step to have the 150. You're like, can't remember what the exact figure is, and they don't have that.
The problem they've got is they've got, as mentioned before, they have a Remain House and a Leave membership, and that's the basic problem. If the people in the House of Commons reflected the membership of the Tory party, should be out.
And well,
but they don't.
Actually, the survey of members that came out this week showed that the percentage of Conservative members who are also leavers, among them, the percentage that think May is doing a good job has fallen from 73% to 52%. Mm-hmm. But it's still 52%. Yeah. I mean, that's still quite high given her position. only one in five think that she should step down immediately. It strikes me that her position is
utterly stupid.
You say that, but when it comes to who they think should take over,
no idea.
Jacob Rees-Mogg who's top of their list. He wins all the sort of head to head contests.
Yeah, but he's a Pied Piper, isn't he?
But having said that, of course, the final two has to be selected by the MPs. If you assume that Jacob Rees-Mogg won't get selected, it looks like Sajid Javid's the one who could do it.
But that would be another soft Remainer.
And it depends when May goes, as you said.
Jacob is lovely and charming and erudite and all the rest of it, but he's a Pied Piper. He can lead the membership, and in the famous phrase about Heseltine, he also knows where that button is. But I actually believe him. He doesn't want it.
I know, I completely agree. He doesn't actually think he wants to be Prime Minister.
And when he says, I don't want that job.
So he might be the first politician in decades to, when actually say, I don't want the job, he really doesn't want the job.
No, I truly believe him. He would be much more coy with that sort of smirk behind the mop top. There would be a coyness about it. And he's absolutely straight up. And I don't believe he's fibbing. I don't.
Order, try to calm down and behave like an adult.
Producer Nick here. I'm joined now by Kyle McGrath from our friends at Ladbrokes. So Kyle, it's been a difficult week for Theresa May. She's lost David Davis, she's lost Boris Johnson. What are the chances of her being replaced as Prime Minister this year?
It's quite an interesting one, Nick, actually. I mean, when it first happened on Monday, the odds fairly tumbled for this year. And we're sort of now seeing a stage where the more shrewder punters are actually sort of angling towards a 2019 or later removal. So, I mean, to give you an inkling, when it first happened, the odds were roughly around 11-2, actually, for an election this year, and they soon tumbled into roughly 2-1, 7-4. And the idea of her exiting as well, you were looking about 7-4 in terms of her leaving this year, and that was, I think by the time Boris had resigned, it was about 1-2. So you were looking at 2-1, you know, punters sort of heavily favouring the idea that this was the year she would go. Like I say, it's now sort of stabilising, I think, momentarily steadied the ship.
You've also got a market open on whether a no-confidence vote might be called before the end of this month. Is that where there's a little bit more value?
Yes, possibly. I mean, again, I suppose you've got slightly more longevity, and the next couple of days, I imagine, will be quite crucial in that. So yeah, there's probably more value in that, I would say, because it probably heavy favours that if she can ride out the next week or two, you'll probably see the exit date probably return to somewhere, you know, as it was before Monday. Whereas I think we've got her leaving now at around 6-5, you'll probably see that sort of go upwards towards again, sort of around the 2-1 mark, if she can ride out the next week or two. So yeah, you probably the value is in that, in the July sort of no confidence market until then.
We've got Gawain Towler in the studio with us this week, and he's been talking about UKIP and the possible return of Nigel Farage. We've got local elections next year, and Gawain thinks that given the Chequers deal, we could be looking at a UKIP surge to 10 or 15 points. What sort of money are you taking on Farage as our next Prime Minister?
Again, recently, especially this week, we've seen quite a few bets actually on Nigel Farage returning, and people with a view looking at him to be in the next Prime Minister market. I mean, today alone we've taken, it might not sound too much, but it's upwards of £100 on people betting on him to be next Prime Minister, odds are around 300-1, which is obviously, you know, slightly speculative on punters' behalves, but you can see the angle if he does look to return to the UKIP fold in March when Gerald Batten stands down. So there's a definite angle there, and it's one that punters are definitely pursuing. But it is still very long odds, obviously, at this stage.
He's currently priced at 300-1, which is behind Tony Blair, David Cameron, not to mention parliamentarians like Owen Smith and Caroline Lucas. 300-1, that seems like a value bet.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, probably people such as Tony Blair, etc., probably do pushing out, I guess. Yeah, I mean, if you were to compare it to people such as that, it's definite value. Probably is one that we'll see short on over the next couple of days. So yeah, I guess if people were going to have a bet on it, it would probably be the time to get on. Mentioning the sort of local election sides, when we saw the Lewisham East by-election, and it was actually very quiet on the UKIP betting front, punters were far more interested actually in Anne-Marie Waters' Fall Britain party actually, and we took probably upwards of 10 times the amount of money on them, either winning the seat or in the sort of match market as well, where we had a UKIP versus Fall Britain. So it could be that we see their popularity grow as well in the market over the next year or so.
So you're not noticing anything in the markets which particularly suggests a UKIP resurgence?
Not massively, other than the bets on Nigel Farage. But of course, I mean, there was a mention, I think it was today or yesterday, from Andrew Bridgen about sort of welcoming into the Conservative Party. But I guess those bets aren't necessarily UKIP related, are they? On the specific UKIP front, then no, there's not a huge amount that we've seen this week.
What do you think is the most popular ice cream configuration product?
Ice cream configuration? 99, really, isn't it? Mr. Whippy thing, I suspect.
Mr. Whippy?
I don't like it, but that I suspect
Mr. Whippy?
Is it.
MLC, what do you think?
Cornetto?
Oh, if we're talking about that. But the one you slice with bits of chocolate in it.
Oh, Viennetta. That's so nice.
But we're thinking more of the kind of thing you eat during hot weather.
I carry a full Viennetta with my hands walking down the street. Just mash my face in it. And don't you dare judge me.
I could do that.
I wouldn't dream of doing that. But what do you think?
I think people do like ice cream vans. And as such, I will stick with the 99.
Well, the winner, by some distance, was the Magnum.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, no, okay,
world's most powerful ice cream. It's 28% of people selected a Magnum.
I respect that.
In the recent,
yeah, you can pick it up from the newsagent. You don't have to have the ice cream van.
The question was actually, what is your favourite ice lolly? And this has created exactly. This has created some controversy over whether that.
Surely the count. Sort of wasabi and cranberry ice lolly that you can get in certain small artisan markets would be the one.
I can promise you with some certainty I would never see a wasabi and cranberry. What's that for Japanese people with cystitis?
It could be. That's quite a constituency.
Remarkable. Joint number two were fabs. I don't like fabs.
I don't know what fabs are.
They're the multicolored ones, kind of like the Tricolore with the hundreds of thousands on top. No, then a Solero, which I tried to convince my niece and nephew was pronounced Solero.
But that's only popular in Scotland.
It's just Alex Salmon. He's an outlier. Yes,
actually, not most. Sadly, among Scottish respondents, Soleros were no more or less popular, despite Alex Salmon's effort. Actually, Calipos, or Calipos, as they're sometimes incorrectly called.
Is that the swirly green one?
No, that's a Twister.
Jesus, how do you have so many ice creams here?
Well, because we have a real sense of cuisine in this country. that's how
it's diverse.
This is a multi ice cream society. Cornetto's 3%. So
only 3%.
They're very solid ice. Yet again,
Marie is in a minority.
just one Cornetto. Give it to Marie.
Yeah, I'll take it.
That's with the other hand.
Yes, I've got the Viennetta in the one, and then, yeah.
And at the bottom of the list, a Knobbly Bobbly, which I'm certain has just been made up.
That sounds like slang for I'm not going to say it. Yeah.
If you've chomped down on a Knobbly Bobbly, then please do tweet us a picture of it.
Never, ever tweet us pictures of your Bobbly Knobblies.
And with that, I think we're going to draw things to a close for this this week. I'm afraid there was no time for our interview with Donald Trump this week, but hopefully we'll get that in next week.
Go to Scotland.
Pretend
to be a golf guard.
I would have to pretend to be a golfer. We leave you instead with just some images from the Panini album that I have, where we can look through all the stickers of our great heroes who are indeed coming home. And there we are. Thank you. We'll speak to you all next week. Bye-bye. Please remember to like, subscribe, review, all these different things that help people hear about us, and do tell all of your friends and many of the people that you don't know, even if you haven't enjoyed the podcast. This is a Poddo podcast produced by Nick Hilton, and our theme tune is by Joe Button.
For more details, go to podopods.com, and for sales and advertising, email nick@podopods.com.
And yes, that's spelled podotpods.com.